All the ships at sea.
Community Radio is celebrating National Radio Day on Saturday, August 20th. We'll be with our friends Freeform Portland, KPSU, and X-Ray at the 10th Annual Centaurpalooza at 2801 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. National Radio Day honors the excitement of radio listening and producing. KBOO stands together with other stations, independent producers, and folks who share a media equity mission on this joyful day. Again, that's National Radio Day, Saturday, August 20th, celebrated on air and at Centaurpalooza from noon to 10 p.m. at 2801 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm/nrd2016.
Good morning. This is Per Fagrang, and the show is Fight the Empire. And my guest today is John Michael Greer, who's author of many books. And the one we're going to talk about is his most recent, Dark Age America. So, John Michael Greer, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on.
What exactly is a dark age? You say the dark ages are kind of all alike, but I think most people think about the one that followed the Roman Empire.
Exactly, because that's the one from which our civilization came. Mm-hmm. The thing to keep in mind with dark ages is that civilizations have life cycles, okay? They're born, they grow, they expand, they plateau, they decline, they fall, and what comes after is a dark age. You have a period in which whatever cultural achievements were made by the previous civilization, some of them get lost, some of them simply sort of putter along on a low scale for a while. You have contracting population rather sharply. You have, all of this sounds very straightforward. What happens is that everything falls apart. You have a time of chaos, and a lot of very messy things happen. And then very gradually, the rebel stops bouncing, and people start putting their lives together again. Your kind of common or garden variety dark age lasts about 400 years.
Well, you say that a sort of declining society, it can't afford all the superstructure, and that's sort of what causes it to collapse.
Well, that's a very important. Like so many things, the process of collapse is overdetermined. There are more actual things feeding into it than have to. But one of the driving factors is what I call catabolic collapse. As you say, any civilization, builds up all of this infrastructure, all of these buildings, all this capital of every kind, but then it has to maintain it. And then, you know, as the more stuff you build, the more the maintenance budgets go up, and eventually you can't afford to maintain everything you built. Especially, of course, this is true if you're doing a lot of what you're doing on non-renewable resources, as we are, and some other civilizations do. So you end up with a maintenance crisis. You can no longer maintain the society you've built, and one of two things happens. Either you go through the sort of collapse and rebuild process. This is what happens with a civilization like China, Imperial China, that had a sustainable basis. You know, everything was running off agriculture and relatively efficient organic agriculture at that. So, you know, you'd have a crash, a dynasty would go down, there'd be a lot of chaos, and then people would pick up and start building again. On the other hand, if everything you're doing is based on non-renewable resources, whether you're farming, say, in a non-sustainable way and you strip your topsoil, or whether you're running off fossil fuels or what have you, when you go down.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's no resources left to build again. And so then you get the full 400-year, more or less, Dark Age experience, complete with, you know, mass migration and all these other fun things. to which we're heading right now.
Well, I think the Roman Empire, one reason it collapsed was it depleted all its soil. And people kind of left the Roman Empire and they migrated up into Western Europe, which at that time was almost like virgin territory.
No. That's not true at all.
It wasn't depleted as Rome was.
No, but the thing is, a lot of the migrations went the other way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the people who currently live in North Italy, many of their ancestors lived in Eastern Europe before Rome came.
Oh, the Vandals, you mean, or what?
Yeah, the Vandals, the Lombards, and so on. Many of the people of Spain are descended from the Visigoths, who originally were in the Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, you get mass migrations, but it's the other thing to keep in mind is population contraction. Now, when I say that, everybody thinks, oh, my God, people dying like flies, epidemics, disasters, apocalypses, this kind of stuff. No. What actually does it is ordinary demographics. If the death rate rises above the birth rate, your population can drop off very quickly. We're actually approaching that in large parts of the world right now. The only reason the United States population is increasing at all right now is that we're bringing in so many people through immigration. If we did not have people coming in through immigration, our population would be in decline right now.
Well, let's talk about some of the, in your book, you have different areas of where this decline is happening. And the first one is sort of in the ecology. That's the most basic, of course. And,
So,
kind of outline that for us a little bit.
Okay. Basically, one of the advantages we have in trying to make sense of the future is that the global climate has varied drastically enough over the prehistoric past, and climate scientists know enough about it, that they can look back and say, okay, what was North America like when it was 2, 3, 4, 5 degrees centigrade warmer? Because it has been, okay? And there's a very simple rule here, which is that the hotter it gets, the drier the western half of the continent gets. During the last ice age, Death Valley was a lake. During the last warm period between ice ages, when it got warmer than it is now, most of the western half of North America was sunblasted desert. So we're looking at a situation where the western half of North America, except for a thin line along the coast, is going to be like the Sahara. Very few people living there, and those only in little oases here and there. What's now the Washington, Oregon, California coast is going to be a little bit like the coast of North Africa, where you have most of the big settlements in that area, but it's pressed up fairly tightly against the sea.
Which is rising,
of course. We'll get to that. I mean, there's all kinds of fun and games. Yeah, you've got the rising oceans. So a lot, I mean, like Sacramento, for example, is going to be underwater in not that many decades, quite possibly, depending on how fast Greenland or the West Antarctic ice sheet break up. But further east, what's now prime agricultural land is going to be dry plains or even desert. And the rain belt shifts, further east. Back here where I live in the Appalachians, you know, we're getting plenty of rain these days, but a lot of the West isn't. So you see that starting to happen. You've got the rising oceans. So you kiss off Florida, kiss off every one of your seaports. You've got the fact that will be happening unpredictably over a period of centuries. So you can never actually just settle down and build something. It's going to be underwater sooner or later. All of these things feed together. We've got, of course, invasive species. We've got shifting climate belts. We've got ecological chaos that our civilization has caused and that our descendants are going to have to put up with for millennia into the future.
Well, then, of course, with all the seaports underwater, this certainly has an effect on the economy. And so, tell us about economic collapse. That's sort of...
Economic collapse. The sort of default option in a dark age, and this has happened in over and over and over again, it's where a civilization ends up. You have a little subsistence communities scattered across a mostly rural landscape, cities largely abandoned, money goes away. Okay. One of the problems with money is that it's so easy to gain. You can play various manipulative games and make a living without actually producing anything of value. So in a dark age, people ditch money. Because they don't want to feed the beast. So you end up in a dark age with a society where people are mostly growing their own food. And, they'd be handing over, 10% of it to the local warlord who keeps them safe from other local warlords and things like that. But there's very little exchange that goes on. people are producing things for their own needs. And again, we're at a much smaller population here. So, so everything, almost everything we now think of as the economy goes away in the transition to a dark age. You know, the market, the, you know, the systems that distribute and organize capital, all of this stuff becomes infrastructure that can no longer be maintained, and it goes away.
Well, you say that the economy is geared to using concentrated energy, and that is running out. So let's talk about that a little bit. You know, peak oil, the ideas surrounding that have changed a bit. I mean, it used to be sort of the simple idea that, you know, you'd have this kind of a bell curve and, and prices would rise. But we seem to be in a situation now where oil is either too expensive for people to buy or it's too cheap for producers to make money off of.
Yeah. This is something, back when the peak oil movement was really a going concern, say 10 years ago, several of us tried to point out that it wasn't just the sort of bell-shaped curve phenomenon, that there were economic lags, there were all kinds of various feedback loops that were going to make the kind of chaotic behavior we have now. And the thing is, the chaotic behavior actually makes it harder to function because, you know, how do you know 2 years down the road, is the price of oil going to be $20 a barrel or is it going to be $200 a barrel? And the economic cost of uncertainty is a huge factor these days already, and it'll be much worse. And back behind all those things, back behind the various economic transformations, back behind the, you know, chaotic swings in prices of oil and other fossil fuels, you've got the simple fact that the Earth is a finite sphere. There is only so much fossil fuel in it. We have already extracted and burnt all of the easy to get, concentrated, relatively unproblematic sources of fossil fuel in the world. We're blowing the tops off entire mountains to get coal that 50 years ago would have been discarded as crap. We're engaging in this bizarre fracking situation, again, in the desperate attempt to get some substance that we can pretend to call petroleum.
Kind of scraping the bottom of the barrel.
And scraping. We've scraped the bottom of the barrel so far. We've gone through the bottom of the barrel. We're digging up, you know, oil-stained dirt underneath.
Well, it's amazing to think that, you know, the first commercial oil well in Pennsylvania, I think they struck oil at 69 feet. And out it came, you know.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what's called the issue of low-hanging fruit, okay? Nobody starts by taking the most expensive end of the resource curve. You look for the oil that's just 69 feet below the ground. You look for the stuff that's the free of sulfur, that's where there's big deposits, where it's easy to process, where it's easy to transport. What that means is that your cost goes up over time, the cost per unit of energy extracted. And not, I should stress, not cost in money. Money is a game. Cost in energy. Okay. And that's where the rubber meets the road. And there are all kinds of gimmicks being used to cover that, to basically ignore that at this point. That to extract a barrel of oil, you have to put a lot more of that barrel back into the oil process to get it out. It's as though, think of it as though a profit and loss kind of thing. Okay, you know, back in the days when oil was coming in, you know, from 69 feet below the ground, you would put one part in 200 into the extraction. So you get a 200 to 1 profit ratio, okay? We were floating on oceans of oil in those days. But the deeper you have to go, the more processing is required, the more exotic the circumstances, the amount of oil you have to take out of each barrel to pay back the energy cost of its extraction goes up. And this is one part of what's called the net energy problem. And that's a major issue because the net energy is the energy profit on which your entire civilization rests. If you don't have enough net energy, you don't have a modern industrial civilization, and those curves are dropping steadily.
Well, there's less money to pay all these different sort of what you call intermediaries, all these layers of management and bureaucracy and advertising and everything else that we have come to get used to. It'd be a lot of
Yeah, that insert themselves between the producer and the consumer of a product. The medical industry is a great example. When I was a child, which was a few years ago now, although I'm not that old, but when I was a child, you went to a doctor, you paid the doctor.
Okay?
It was not that expensive. Now you have this immense, creaking public and private bureaucratic mountain of people, all of whom have to be paid. And we wonder why our medical costs have gone insane. Now, there's a certain amount of just plain old ordinary profiteering and greed. And at corruption, let's not forget that. America is a very corrupt society these days. And there are some other reasons, but a lot of it is simply the incredible metastasis of intermediation, the number of people who have been able to insert themselves between the producer and the consumer of a product. That's more infrastructure. That's going away. So one of the things our listeners can take from this is that if you're employed as an intermediary, if you're not actually producing a service or a good or a service that people actually use, you may want to look at changing your job to something where you actually produce something of value, because you may not have a job indefinitely.
Well, let's get into technology, because I don't know, sometimes I think right now technology is sort of our national religion. We expect all sorts of things from it.
That's a very good description. One of my fellow Peak Oil writers has commented that when he does speeches and talks about, look, we are running up against hard limits, one of the things that happens is that all these people wave their iPhones at him as though that proves that, no, we're going to zoom off towards some kind of Star Trek future. Most of our technology at this point consists of more and more elaborate ways to do the same things that we did much more simply 20 or 50 or 100 years ago. What does the Internet actually do that people weren't getting done, maybe not quite as conveniently, but they were getting done with perfect efficiency in, say, 1916? In 1916, people were getting mail in some parts of the world. And for example, in London, they were delivering mail 6 times a day. So they were getting their email. They were reading articles. Okay, you have a newsstand. You go to now pick up the latest weekly magazine. People were exchanging cute pictures of kittens. They were looking at pictures of people with their clothes off. They were doing all the things that people do on the Internet now. It's just that they were doing it in a relatively low-tech, low-energy, less low complexity, low intermediary way. Now we've got, we've got a galaxy of server farms, each of which uses as much electricity as a city. And those server farms, you talk to somebody who actually works in one, they're literally, they've got a loading dock and they're having semis pull up every single day to offload electronic components to replace the ones that will burn out that day. They're incredibly wasteful of energy, of resources, of materials, but because people don't see that, there's this idea that the Internet is somehow clean. So we have this incredibly elaborate superstructure of technology to do things that people did perfectly well without the technology, again, 20 or 50 or 100 years ago. This does not mean that we are somehow more advanced. It means that we're more vulnerable. It means that we are more efficiently exploited economically. It means that
more easily hacked.
Exactly. It means we're easily hacked. It means that we're easily tracked by the government or anyone else who happens to do so. It doesn't actually benefit us that much. But people are so into, as you say, the religion of technology, the religion of progress, the idea that our hope of salvation consists of stumbling blindly ahead along the same linear course that we're engaged in now. We cannot do anything different. We have to keep going the same direction we're going now, more and more complex versions of the same tech we've got, until we fall off a cliff.
Well, I got an article right here as from an English newspaper very recently, and the headline says, "The Matrix Overloaded. Computers will use more electricity than the entire world can generate by 2040. Tech experts claim." I think this is from the London Express.
That is to say, one of two things is going to happen. Either electricity is going to become extremely expensive, or computers are going to run into limits to growth. And I think probably it's going to be both, actually.
Well, I have to say, I really like the Internet for one thing. I do a lot of going to different sources for my show. And I start out in the morning and I go through. If I had to do that at the library, actually reading, getting these things from the ship, from the rack somewhere, it would take an awful lot of time. Mm-hmm. So I'm able to kind of go through a lot of information.
Yeah, but the thing is, you're not remembering that there used to be ways to simplify that.
Mm-hmm.
There used to be, for one example, if you need a wide assortment of things from the media, there used to be what were called clipping bureaus,
mm-hmm.
where people would literally go through newspapers and magazines and clip out the articles that were of specific interest to you and send you a packet every day.
Mm-hmm.
You had periodicals that existed solely for the purpose of letting you know what's out there, so you didn't have to do a lot of running around. And, of course, back in the days when libraries were well-funded and well-stocked, you could walk into them, ask the librarian, and 5 minutes later you're sitting at a desk with a stack, 3 feet tall. The Internet is a convenience. I grant that. It's nice not to have to walk the 6 blocks to my local public library sometimes, although I do it all the time, to look something up. Of course, I also have an encyclopedia, an old encyclopedia from the 1950s, and a very large library. So, there's a lot of stuff
mm-hmm.
you can do. It's just you have to start thinking about, okay, what are the workarounds? If we don't have the kind of absurd supplies of energy and resources that we're currently burning through right now, how do you handle this? There are usually very efficient ways, and the best way to find them is to say, okay, what was being done 20 or 50 or 100 years ago before the Internet?
Is there any possibility of a scaled-down Internet? Because I was reading recently about people in Cuba, they sort of organized their own, I guess, Internet. It's not a big, wide Internet is just sort of for, I don't know how many people, 50, 100 or whatever, but it's scaled down, and I guess it's, is that sustainable?
No.
Well, okay.
Basically, computer technology is probably not sustainable over the long term. It'll have to be rediscovered if people find it of use, simply because it uses so much in the way of resources. I mean, to have a computer, you think of the factories, you think of the mines, you think of the clean rooms, you think of the elaborate machinery needing to make microchips and so on. All of that has to be sustained.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly in dark age conditions, it's not going to be around. And it's, whether or not these civilizations that build on our ruins end up rebuilding that, that's another question. They'll decide based on their interests, their concerns, the things they value. If there is going to be any kind of transitional scaled-down Internet for the period, the process of decline before we actually hit Dark Age conditions, people had better start building it right now.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of the things. There is a lag time. One of my favorite slogans, collapse now and avoid the rush. If you know mm-hmm. where we're headed,
mm-hmm.
the sooner you go to that level and get comfortable there and learn how to function there, the fewer disruptions you're going to face.
Mm-hmm.
Because, living with less technology actually takes a little practice. You need to learn how to do it.
Well, what about video games and robots? Robots are big now. In fact,
okay.
I heard.
What about video games? I mean, I tend to think of video games as sort of an electronic drug, a way that people can numb themselves to the wretchedness of everyday life in a declining industrial society, and they'll probably be around as long as people can afford them. Robots. One of the crucial things here is that we've got a regulatory and tax structure that rewards unemployment. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
If an employer hires somebody, they have to pay Social Security, they have to pay, health care. They have all of these additional costs piled on. If they buy a piece of automated equipment, that counts as a capital investment, and they benefit from it.
Mm-hmm.
So we're literally incentivizing laying off people and replacing them with machinery. If we did not have that kind of absurd, counterproductive incentive in place, we'd hire more people and forget about the robots.
Mm-hmm. Well, I recently read a remark by Noam Chomsky says that no robot is as creative as a 4-year-old.
Exactly. And when the other thing to keep in mind is that a human worker does not have to be supplied with, X precise voltage and amperage of electricity and these very narrowly defined spare parts and blah, blah, blah. You know, a human worker can be fed on food and quite a range of foods. Their requirements are just so much simpler. And in a declining society, actually makes much more sense to hire human workers because you need to, you're going to need to ration your technology for the things where it's most needed as shortages come down the pike, as we start running out of essential minerals and things like that. Human beings, they're easy to produce. In fact, they reproduce themselves quite enthusiastically. And you know, and they're not that expensive to, all things considered, in a situation to decline, to feed, to house, to provide the other necessities of, and pleasures of life for. They're just much more economical. Mm-hmm. It's simply that we have this system of perverse incentives in place caused by our belief in the inevitability and goodness of progress, our religious faith in progress, that tilts the thing toward the machine and away from the worker. Reverse those, we'd probably get rid of our unemployment problem within a few years.
Well, so how do we live in a kind of a dark age, depleted world? You know, I think of, in some ways, you know, I think it might have been an improvement over Roman civilization, at least for some people.
This is the thing that people tend to forget. Right now, for most people in the industrial world, life sucks.
Mm-hmm.
Life really does suck. And it's going to get worse. This is true in Roman times. What happens, of course, is that as things start tightening up, who hangs on to the biggest share of the pie? The people who have the wealth and power, okay? And so everyone below them, starting from the bottom, gets the shaft more and more.
And the people at top are not aware of it.
No, they're totally clueless. Mm-hmm. Listen to one of our recent presidential candidates insisting, no, everything's fine in America. I would invite her to come out to some neighborhoods. I can show her. But not that she would, of course. But, yeah, they're totally isolated, living in a bubble, a self-enclosed bubble, and believing their own propaganda. Whereas outside, people are being driven down into misery and poverty over, you know, further and further. When the superstructure falls, I mean, who's supporting all of that superstructure? Who's supporting that self-referential bubble in which the politicians live and all the perks, all the privileges, all the absurd extravagance that's their ordinary life? It's the working poor. And so when they no longer have to support, whether it's a Roman bureaucracy or an American one, and, you know, they have to support a local warlord. Local warlords have come cheap compared to bureaucracies.
Mm-hmm.
And so, in fact, you can see this in the transition from late Roman to Dark Age periods. For the sort of average schmuck, it was an improvement.
Feudalism, I think it really arose in areas that were under a lot of contention, but my understanding is that in areas that were kind of out of the way, like the Swiss Alps or Pyrenees or Scandinavia, you didn't really have the kind of feudalism you have sort of in France and England and Germany.
Yeah. So this term feudalism actually covers a very large number of things. It takes many shapes. And of course, as a result, I think largely of 100 years of Marxist rhetoric, it's one of our favorite strawmen. People love to beat up on feudalism. Now, in fact, if you actually do the research, you'll find that a medieval peasant worked fewer hours and had more days off than an American does today.
Mm-hmm.
They also took home a larger share of the product of their work. So the thing that made feudalism work is that it was entirely based on personal relationships.
Mm-hmm.
It was entirely a matter of, you know, I have this relationship to this other person, and it's not an equal relationship. Grant that. We talk about equality now, but give me a break. We don't have it. No human society does. In a feudal society, the inequality is recognized, and the idea is that everybody has responsibilities toward the other people in this specific relationship. You know, here's the baron, I'm a peasant, okay, I pledge myself to this baron, he pledges himself to me, I get these things, he gets those things, hopefully we're satisfied. Now, later on, you get the kind of corruption that leads to, say, pre-revolutionary France, where the nobles could care less about, you know, any responsibilities they might have had. But in Dark Age conditions, you can't get away with that. because somebody can always whack you over the head with a battle axe. And, of course, in a dark age, that happens all the time. So there's a certain amount of checks and balances here.
Well, maybe I'd like to think that if these communities could protect themselves better, that they might not need the feudal overlords. But I think we're going to have to end on that because we're at the end of our time. I've been talking with John Michael Greer, the author of Dark Age America and numerous other books. And you also have... They can read your articles on the Arch Druid Report. Tell us a little bit about that. We have just about a minute.
That is a weekly blog. Every Wednesday evening, I put up a post on the future of industrial society or some theme related to it. And that's http://thearchdruidreport.blogspot.com. On the other hand, if you have trouble remembering that, simply use a search engine for the word Archdruid. It's usually on the first page.
There we go. Okay, well, thank you very much, John Michael Greer, the author of Dark Age America. Thank you for being with us.
And thank you for having me.
And this has been Fight the Empire. Stay tuned to KBOO, your radio station.
That's right, KBOO Portland is your community radio station. 1 minute before 10 o'clock, we're about 15 minutes away from doing a special. We've got no flashpoints today. Instead, we've got Cover to Cover, a special show from KPFA. That is coming up. Also, we'll have Between the Covers at 11 o'clock this morning with your host, David Naiman. Up next, Chris Andre is in the building with Air Cascadia. So stick around, that is coming up next.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Montevilla Jazz Festival taking place August 20th and 21st at Portland Metro Arts in Portland. The Montevilla Jazz Festival focuses on Portland's originally composed progressive jazz scene and will feature Jeff Baker, The In-Betweens, the Jessica Smith Big Band, Batita Differente, and many more, including a full lineup on the student stage. Again, that's the Montevilla Jazz Festival taking place August 20th and 21st at Portland Metro Arts, 9003 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.